Now, as I indicated to you at the outset, I want to do something different in regard to this virtue. I'm not going to just stand up here and deliver a straight presentation of a good, rational, account of the topic, but rather, using a Hollywood metaphor, take you behind the scenes. The first time that I wrote the section on the virtue of independence, which was years ago, I made some disastrous errors in method, in epistemological approach, which led to all kinds of baffling confusions in regard to the content, and I was in a period of total chaos. And gradually, across many weeks, by a series of steps, I discovered the error, and I had polished and edited the whole passage completely down to the word choices and the punctuation. I had to throw the whole thing out entirely and redo it from scratch. I may say I made, once I saw the error, I realized that I did it in one form or another on every one of the virtues. That's why that chapter ended up taking me so incredibly long to do. But the error was most dramatic in regard to independence because it was the first of the derivative virtues. Now, I'm going into this topic here at the Jefferson School rather than just read you the present polished, completely, great version. Because my problem, I think, is a really terrific example of how a wrong epistemological approach can destroy you, even if you have a great deal of knowledge and the best intentions in the world. So I'm really, in effect, this is an all-out example to plug the importance of epistemology. And I'm doing it on myself and myself as the goat. Now, first I'm going to give you an outline of my initial attempt. Now, for purposes today, I'm just going to tell you in substance what it was, but you have to try to remember that this was polished and eloquent and clear. It had every virtue. It was just wrong. So don't be thrown off by the roughness of my wording here. And I want you to listen and try to detect the essential errors. Now, Chris, you have one great advantage over me. I thought it was right. You know it's wrong. And there's really only one all-encompassing error. And after I've given you the presentation, I will take you through the steps of how I discovered the error and then conclude by giving you the final correct presentation. Now, the context for this virtue was and remains fine. I've established life as the standard, rationality as the basic virtue, egoism, all that's covered. Now we turn to independence. Now, I started, as always, with a definition. And in fact, this one misran herself defined. So I began by giving the definition. The subhead, by the way, for what it's worth, and it is very instructive, was independence as self-reliance in thought and action. And then I started with Ayn Rand's definition, which I'll quote to you. Independence is one's acceptance of the responsibility of forming one's own judgments and of living by the work of one's own mind. Unquote. One's acceptance of the responsibility of forming one's own judgments and of living by the work of one's own mind. Unquote. So I wrote that down. I figured, well, that's terrific. I know that every virtue has two aspects, one pertaining to consciousness and one pertaining to existence. And here she gives both of them in the definition. Form your own judgments and live by the work of your own mind. So all I have to do is state the definition and then take it one half at a time and validate each half. So after the definition, the first topic was intellectual independence. And remember, this is a treatise on ethics. I can't just assert these things. I got to validate. Why should you be intellectually independent? How do you validate? Well, it seemed obvious to me. Now, some of this, what I'm about to say, is true. So the fact I put it in the past tense doesn't mean it's all wrong. You have to distinguish. But it seemed obvious to me that the way to validate intellectual independence was to reduce it to rationality, which I'd already established. After all, dependent thinking is a contradiction in terms. If you're being dependent on someone else, you're not thinking, you're not looking at reality. So essential to exercising judgment is exercising your own judgment. So what it came down to is, and I expressed this all very clearly, but it came down to, if you're not intellectually independent, you're really not thinking, you're not being rational. And of course, that I've taken care of in the preceding chapter. Okay, then that brought me to existential independence, or independence in action. Now I get to, how do you validate that one? Suppose now we've got a person who says, okay, I'm going to be intellectually independent. I'm going to, quote, accept the responsibility of forming my own judgments. Now, the second part, living by the work of one's own mind. Well, how could you validate that one? Now, I'm going to read you from my old attempt, because the wording is very instructive. This is polished writing, mind you. In other words, this is not rough. I'm only giving you an excerpt. This is the start of my validation. Thought is not an end in itself, but a guide to action in reality. And man cannot act on his conclusions without the material means necessary to implement them. Hence, the virtue of independence requires, as an essential component, that a man accept the responsibility of acquiring these means, i.e. that he be self-reliant and sovereign not only in the realm of thought, but also in regard to the attainment and use of material goods. Independence, therefore, requires self-sustenance. It means supporting your life and financing your actions by your own effort and work, as against being a beggar or a criminal who survives as a parasite on the labor of others. Now, if you get the intention, I grant you that's a very confused paragraph, but if you get the intention there, I was trying to derive existential independence from intellectual independence. My argument is, in effect, if you're not existentially independent, then you have to conform to the demands or standards of the people that you're depending on, the providers of the largesse. You have to, in effect, develop a psychology of obedience, which is the opposite of intellectual independence. Now, I thought I'd better give an example. So I picked what I thought is a great example, Robert Stadler. I thought I'll concretize and really give weight to this point and demonstrate on a particular example that if you're an existential dependent, you can't be intellectually independent. And since I've already established that, I will now have validated in existential independence. Now I'll read you the Stadler part. This is what I'm trying to prove. It is futile to attempt to sustain independence in the realm of thought while shrugging off any responsibility to achieve wealth and counting on the charity of others. In other words, while practicing beggary in the realm of matter and action. An eloquent example of this attempt is Robert Stadler, the brilliant theoretical physicist in Atlas Shrugged, who disdains as vulgar any concern with making money, and who proceeds to acquire the money he needs for his work in the form of handouts from the government. And now I'm going to show how this wrecks his mental processes, you see. In the nature of the case, the dependent in matter rejects the essence of virtue. His survival depends on conforming not to the facts of reality, but to the opinions and desires of those who support him. To the extent, if any, that those who pay the bills are responsible men, they will have to set terms for the use of their property. For example, study the countless volumes of rules and regulations issued by Washington, the volumes defining in detail what businessmen, bankers, doctors, and so on must, can, and cannot do when they spend federal funds. To the extent, however, that the bill payers are irresponsible men, it is deuces wild and even worse for the recipient. Such men will demand anything or nothing and then switch the setup the next hour or month, i.e. they will act according to their whim of the moment, which thus becomes the basic law of their dependent's life. For example, study the ceaseless, senseless changes through the years in all the above federal rules. Either way, the providers of the largesse become the rulers of the recipient. To an individual who lives under such rule, independent thought is not a virtue. Now I'm cashing in. On the contrary, in direct proportion to a man's existential dependence, thought becomes to him an irrelevant indulgence and even a positive threat. It is an indulgence because his actions are not determined any longer by his own conclusions, but by the decisions of others. His is not to reason why, but to obey. It is a threat because thought by its nature is the antonym of obedience. Now, I went on to give another example, which I'm not going to take the time to read, pertaining to life in Soviet Russia. Again, the idea being, since the state has control of all the economic means of survival, of the physical world, of all the goods and so on, the citizen is left helpless, unable to act, choose, and therefore with the feeling that his mind is useless and that there's no point in thinking, and therefore he abandons thought and escapes into chess, or alcoholism, etc. Now, you have to realize that I'm doing a heroic thing here, because there's nothing worse than reading aloud as your own a passage such as I've just done, which is as grossly wrong as what I've done. But I'm doing it because, partly I hope you'll find it instructive, and partly I get credit for having found it, so that cancels out the blame for having committed it. But I hope you see the essence of my argument. The essence of the validation was this: rationality, which I've already taken care of, entails intellectual independence. Intellectual independence entails existential independence. And therefore, I've closed the circle and validated the virtue. Now, that was the essence of the presentation. As I said, there was many more details and better formulations and so on, but that was the substance of it. The time came to do the very final editing, you know, where you just squeeze out the few excess words here and there, change semicolons to commas or periods, that type of thing. And I had given a couple of days, assigned in my mind a couple of days, to just give it that final coat of polish. And then it began to strike me that something is wrong with this. And I'm going to give you some of the clues in the order that they came to me. For one thing, I didn't like the examples. I felt there's something much too political about this whole discussion. This is a chapter on virtue, and here is virtue number one. All I can got as really good examples is what's wrong with being a government scientist and what's wrong with Soviet Russia. Now, this is a universal virtue. Why are the examples all political? There must be all kinds of examples in daily life where the government is simply not involved, as in the case of justice or all the other virtues. Why are only political examples occurring to me? But for the life of me, I couldn't think of any decent examples, that my mind just seemed to dry up. Now that, of course, right away was a sign of something. When you find that you can only think of one category of example, I'm giving you this as general guidance, and you cannot range freely over the total spectacle of human life Or when you do, everything leaves you completely blank except for one narrow subtype. Something is really wrong. Now, on rereading it, you know, you have to, Ayn Rand once told me a piece of advice which I never forgot. You should put it away when you have written something. Come to it the next day. Well, in my case, it takes about a month. The next month. But then read it absolutely with a cold eye. Not as though you've written it, but as though somebody else wrote it. And you're reading it, you know, with the slight suspicion that you have when you read anything, you know, what kind of person is this? What does he mean? What does he say? Why did he put it that way? Not, you know, if you carry that one step too far, then of course you'll tear anything apart and you'll become paranoid. But you have to look at it with a completely objective eye, and that you trained me to do. So as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, first, I don't like the quality of his examples. I always put it in the third person, his examples. And the next thing that occurred to me is, why is he making such a big fuss about validating existential independence? All this long, tortured discussion about beggars. And the whole thing reads as though my message is, at last, thanks to Ayn Rand, we can prove what's wrong with being a beggar. And as soon as I said that, I said, this is ridiculous. Ayn Rand's genius is not required to show what's wrong with being a beggar. Any decent person on the street knows that the beggar has a double standard. You work and I'll collect. So the idea of working for a living versus sponging off of others is common sense. What doesn't require genius. And then it occurred to me, if you read through that passage, I make no real use of Ayn Rand's actual basic philosophy in the presentation at all. There is no use of the metaphysics or epistemology or of the meta-ethics or of anything. And the subheading reveals it. This is why Ayn Rand had the ability, from reading the opening paragraph of somebody's presentation, to state what was going to be on page 38. Because she could see right away from the opening words, if you use this word, your controlling premise must be so and so, and that will lead you to such and such. And I always thought she had like an uncanny mystic ability, because she would tell me from reading the opening line what I was saying 20 pages later, when I hadn't known it, when, you know, that it was coming, when I wrote it. And I see now entirely how she did it, because it was right in my subtitle heading was, independence, what was it? Self-reliance in thought and action. Well, if all I've got to say is be self-reliant, in effect, think for yourself and support yourself, this is the old Protestant ethics. You know what they call the Protestant ethic. Who needs a fancy metaphysics and the concept formation and the whole business? For that, they arrived at that hundreds of years ago. So that makes me think there's something really wrong here. First, I can't find any decent examples. Second, I have gotten off on, quote, common sense and dropped objectivism. So I'm starting to get really worried that maybe there are more than just word changes required here. Then I began to, you know, once certain antennae go up, you think then this can't be an accident, there's really something off. The next thing that occurred to me, and that was the killer, was that my validation was completely backwards. Upside down and reverse. Because my argument amounted to, why should you be existentially independent?
Well, I answered, so that you can be intellectually independent. And why that? So you can be rational. And why that? Well, I've already proved that in my previous chapter. Now, the real truth is the exact reverse. You are supposed to think independently so that you can support your life.
It's not support your life so that you can think independently. And yet that's what my whole validation amounted to. Support yourself, be self-supporting so that you can go on thinking independently. Now that implies that thought is the end, the goal, and action is merely a means to it, which is a complete reversal of the objectivist viewpoint. Well, by now, once I realized that, I could see, I didn't know what was right, but I knew already what was the error. Now, who can tell me, in a word, Which this is as classic an example of error, epistemological error, as was ever constructed. What in a single word is this the perfect example of?
Rationalism.
This is rationalism through and through and through. It is if A, then B. If B, then C, etc. All of it in a vacuum. Deduction apart from reality. A floating world of ideas. You start with some axiom. In this case, I have already established rationality in the preceding chapter. And then you show it leads to the next, which leads to the next, just like in mathematics. And of course, once you look at it, you see that it had all the earmarks of being rationalist. That's why, for instance, I couldn't find examples. Because one sign of rationalism, since you've departed from reality and you're just playing with words in your own mind, is you can't think of examples. Whenever you look at reality, you get that cramped feeling that you just can't extract any information out of it. You can't find what you're supposed to be talking about. And another very typical feature of rationalism is that long, laborious proof of the evil of being a beggar. Once you're cut off from reality, you lose the sense of what is obvious or what isn't. Every point takes on a life of its own in this deductive chain. And so you get at the same time detailed proofs of the obvious and glaring omissions of the necessary, side by side, because you're wearing blinders and all you do is follow the chain. All of this is signs of not looking at reality, but instead deducing floating abstractions in a vacuum. Well, of course, once I grasped this much, I realized the whole thing must be completely wrong from beginning to end. So I started to read it with a jaundiced eye. And it began to spring leaks all over the place. Every paragraph, every point. I said, you can't possibly say that. What about this? How can you say this? How about this? And the whole thing disintegrated entirely, and it became completely baffling to me that I could ever have written it. It was so obviously defective. Now, at this point, I'm going to leave it with you. See how many things you can come up with that is wrong with it. How many, I'll even give you some clues. Here are some questions that you can think of. Can't you argue that a parasite or a criminal sometimes has to think in order to gain his ends? What about Peter Keating? How does he fit in here? He's not a beggar. He's not a criminal. Well, I don't want to give you too much, because if I give you too much, you allow, go range over the list of types of people and see to what extent I have or have not included the kinds of examples that really belong under the category of existential independence, and how you really would validate existential independence, or more broadly, how you would validate independence as such. And you see what you can come up with between now and Thursday. On Thursday, I want to start by giving you the further problems in that sequence, or seeing what you got, and then show you how I reconstructed it and end up with the proper one. So you'll have to hold your negative views of me in abeyance until Thursday, because it will have a happy ending then. Thank you very much.
Okay, let us pick up now with the discussion that we cut off in the middle last time with regard to the virtue of independence. I gave you the essence of my first utterly erroneous presentation, which was the purely rationalistic deduction: rationality entails intellectual independence, which in turn entails existential independence. And I indicated some of the problems with that.
I also suggested, I hinted at the very end, some further problems. So before I turn to what you did, I may as well cash in on those few hints and get them out of the way, since I couldn't restrain myself at the end last time and already gave away a few lesser points. In any event, once I realized that this presentation was essentially rationalistic, I began to look at it with a jaundiced eye, that is, a skeptic eye, from the point of view of knowing it's wrong, how much can I find is wrong? And then it began to spring leaks everywhere. One of the first questions that occurred to me was, doesn't the parasite or the criminal, taking those as obvious examples of the existential dependent, have to think, use his mind, and often on his own, by himself, in order to figure out how to gain from others the thing he wants, how to manipulate them, become their rulers, devise great bank robbing schemes, and so on? Now, in this kind of case, it seemed to me, intellectual independence was a means to existential dependence. And if that were possible, then something is really incredibly wrong with my whole validation, which was supposed to be that intellectual independence is what necessitates existential independence. It certainly wiped out one more time my entire validation, and then I began to wonder, what is wrong with that? Of course, I know, and I can give a case, that in some sense, a bank robber is not an exponent of thought. I mean, I'm, you know, a veteran enough to be able to lecture on that point, but here I'm trying to really think the thing out. And after all, there is a difference between an innovative bank robber, you know, who really puzzles and works out an ingenious new plan, who is in some sense being independent in his thinking about bank robbing, as against a conventional moron who just copies all the other bank robbers in the tried and true fashion. Now, at this point, I didn't know the answer to that question. My mind trailed off into chaos, as if, you know, that clash and contradiction. It can't be true that he's an exponent of independence, but it seems as though he is, and there's something, I don't know. When your mind starts to trail off into chaos, that is always a sign, at least in my case, that there is something basic off in the whole approach, and that's why every lead dissolves. Wherever you go, it just dissolves into chaos. And now the other hint I gave you last time, which I wanted to mention to you, it suddenly occurred to me with a jolt of horror, what am I going to do with Peter Keating? Now, I had written this whole section the first time with the idea that there's the self-supporting man, as against, if you remember, I actually read you the passage, as against the moochers and the looters, or the beggars and the criminals. Those being the two outstanding categories from Atlas, and they fit into my deduction fine. And now that I'm reading it with a jaundiced eye, I thought to myself, what am I going to do with Peter Keating? He is the epitome of dependence. He was created by Ayn Rand to illustrate dependence on every level, not just intellectually but existentially, yet he is self-supporting in a sense, certainly in the sense required by my text, because he's not a beggar. He doesn't go around with the tin cup. He doesn't even ask for government favors. And he's not a criminal. He doesn't even get his contracts through government deals and manipulation. So he doesn't ask for charity. He doesn't initiate force. He holds down a regular job. His customers come to him voluntarily. He deals with men by trade. So according to everything I've written in this sequence, I thought to myself in horror, Peter Keating comes out on the side of being an independent man. So, you know, I knew already it was wrong, but this was the last straw. Now, at this point, let me ask you, in the form of a question now, who sees what's wrong with this?
just this much. What would you say about Peter Keating? Now, if you have taken this seminar before, a handful of you here have, it is really unfair, unjust, to volunteer. I want this from people who really are groping on their own. Yes?
I think that there's not to deal with the essentials. In other words, existentially, Peter Keating might be making money and so on, but it is originally from the thought and effort of other people, and he's basically copying.
Okay, and you're making a really good point. She says it doesn't deal with the essentials. He is existentially making money, but the crucial thing is the thought from which the money comes, and that is not his own. And that is a very good point. You came to it faster than I did. But I thought I will check against Ayn Rand's definition. Now, you remember I quoted you that definition. And, you know, she picks every word in every sentence, but particularly in a definition, for a definite reason. And very often I found the clue in when she uses a word that I wouldn't quite use. It's tremendously instructive why I wouldn't quite use it, because it always indicates some incredible error on my part. Now, here is her, I'll repeat to you the definition that she gave. One's acceptance of the responsibility of forming one's own judgments and of living by the work of one's own mind. Now, mind you, existential independence was living by the work of one's own mind. Now, in my discussion, I turned that into living by one's own actions, as against a beggar or a criminal, you see. but when you make it the issue of living by the work of your own mind, it's obvious then that Peter Keating is not an example of existential independence. But now the thing starts to blur in my mind because, well, how do I distinguish existential independence from intellectual independence? Because here I'm making the whole thing a big distinction between the first half is intellectual and the second is existential. And now to be existentially independent, part of the definition is you have to, you see, function by the use of your own minds. You have to be intellectually independent. So now it seems like the whole distinction is collapsed, and again my mind, I know there's a difference between mind and body, so there has to be a difference between the intellectual and the existential sides of this virtue. And now by getting rid of one error, I plunge myself into another of obliterating the whole distinction between mind and body. So I just, again, I had that experience. My mind is trailing off into chaos. I don't know where I am, and I'm swimming completely. Now, at this point, before you take the elaboration any further, I did what I strongly suggest to you in this type of case. When you start finding examples that you cannot deal with, the best thing in a case like that is to range over the total and try to find more examples, because you, and perhaps you will find enough different kinds of examples so you'll be able to see a common denominator or a lead, you know, that will give you a clue as to where you're going wrong. So once I had that, my original presentation left out Peter Keating and left out innovative bank robbers, I began to wonder what other kinds of things did I leave out, or could I not encompass by this simple-minded idea of self-reliance versus beggars and criminals. Now, what kind did you come up with that raised questions or that would have to be covered one way or the other in a discussion of existential independence that we haven't yet mentioned? Because there's at least two other crucial types of examples that occurred to me about which I had been oblivious, you know, just blissfully silent, because they never occurred to me the first time around. And once I started this survey of reality, they just sprung to mind. Now, who can, a lady at the back. I see your hand, but not your face. Yeah. Oh, I guess we just, all right, yes.
How about the one of these fundamentalist preachers who gets a great deal of...
Terrific. Great. I had a variant of that, but that's exactly where my mind went next. You say, what about a fundamentalist preacher? And I had a variant of that. The thought that occurred to me, and it was just by extension from Keating, was, what about free market mystics who sell their services voluntarily? So they're not beggars. In fact, a lot of them, you know, are out to make money, and they collect a lot, and they have Rolls Royces, etc. And there's no force, there's no crime, etc. And then I started to make, there's a whole list of them. You mentioned preachers, fundamentalist preachers, but you could include religious leaders broadly across the board in this category. Or what about astrologers? That's the one that occurred to me first. You know, Jean Dixon and that type. She is certainly not a beggar or a criminal, but she is never would qualify as living by the work of her own mind. So something here, it's in the same category as Keating, only the difference is Keating is in a legitimate field, and she isn't even in a legitimate one. But there's nevertheless some common denominator. Then, of course, once I thought of that, I thought of what about all the corrupt professors in the world? You know, the linguistic analysts and the rat psychologists, you know, you can make lists of them. They are self-supporting, but they are certainly not independent in Ayn Rand's definition. So, are they existentially independent or not? Now, I know they're not intellectually independent. I mean, if they are simply mouthing, you know, the conventions of their subculture. What do you do with them? Where do they go? All right, so we've got vast numbers of people who, quote, work for a living, but are not independent for some reason I can't entirely yet explain. Now the thought occurred to me, well, where would you go now? Suppose you've got, you're trying to find out what's the connection between working for a living and being independent. And you see a lot of people who are working but are not independent. What obvious question, just by looking at the thing from the opposite direction, might now occur to you? Yes.
They're independent but not working.
Well, yeah, what about try in reverse? Can you think of cases of people who are independent but don't work? Now that would really tear it. You see, I'm trying now to cover the waterfront. These are all the examples, you see, that didn't come the first time, because the first time I was just busy making my deductions with that reference to reality. But now we're really looking at it. And to tell you the truth, autobiographically, the first thing that occurred to me in this connection is, what about me? No, I mean, philosophy has to start at home. Now, let's suppose I say I'm rational, I'm in focus, etc., but basically I'm an heir. That is to say, I live on royalties willed to me by Ayn Rand. So do I qualify as self-supporting? And then I tried, you know, you have to be the advocate of the devil. I said, couldn't somebody argue, in effect, Peter Keating is better on this count than Peacock? No, but wait a minute, you have to hear the reasoning. Because he at least has to go to work every day. Whereas I can stay in bed if I want. And even if I don't, my own work is not necessary to my support. So where am I left? Am I existentially independent, or am I a parasite on Ayn Rand? So now, you know, it began to seem obvious, now that we have these flood of examples, that existential independence does not equal making your living on a free market by some kind of work. That obviously can't be a valid point. So somehow it has to pertain to the quality of the work or the quality of the worker, not just the fact of going to work or not, and not just the fact of voluntary relations with others. That whole issue of dealing with others voluntarily is a red herring here. It's not essential. Holding down a job is not an essential. It has to do somehow with the quality of the mind, but we're talking on the existential level. And that was the puzzle. So where are we now? It's helpful every time you get in a complete quandary to try to summarize where you are. On the one hand, I have a series of floating abstractions linked by deduction. And side by side with that, I have a bunch of concretes that I cannot relate to my abstractions. And that, of course, is the perfect picture of a full-fledged rationalist. On one side, he's got a neat series of abstractions, but unfortunately, on the other side is reality with all of its untidy concretes that he can't connect one to the other at all. He's completely lost. So whereas I'm floating half the time, the other half the time, I've become really concrete-bound, agonizing over astrologers and heirs. And where do I classify them? So I said, something here is really basically wrong. What am I missing? There must be something, some insight, some grasp, some perspective that if I had, would transform this chaos into clarity. Now, at the risk of you pushing us over the edge into total chaos, give me an idea, those of you who are hearing this for the first time, what am I missing? Because it's at this point that I got the climactic observation, not of the answer, but of what I was missing. Now, who has a clue? Of course, by wording it that way, you know you have to supply something. I didn't know whether I had to subtract or add something, whether there was an outright error of content or whether I needed something new. And what I found is I needed something new, but what did I need? Yes.
It seems on one issue at least that you're equivocating on the word live by the work of your mind. Does that not necessarily mean earn a living or make your survival depend on the work of your mind? Doesn't it mean guide your life by the work of one's mind?
Well, you're giving me an answer that's too specific for what I'm looking for. You tell me I'm equivocating on living and that means really properly guide your life by the actions of your mind, not just earn your daily bread. But I'll just point out to you the perils of what you're saying. That, of course, is true, but you're verging on the virtue of rationality. Now, remember, if we're doing the virtue of independence, it can't be just a synonym for rationality. True, it's a very intimate relation to rationality, but it's in some sense an aspect, a derivative, a narrowing, one element of rationality. And you can always, rationality is easy because it's very general. So you can escape from all problems in any particular virtue by retreating to the general statement of be rational. But you're losing what makes it this particular virtue. So living by the work of your own mind has to be more specific than simply following reason in action. This is a concrete under that. All the virtues are, you see. So you're still not telling me, what am I missing? Now, if I don't get it the next time, I'm going to give you a hint that's going to make it unmistakable. I want somebody different each time, and I can't tell from just fingers. Yes? Yes.
It seems to me like first, can I give one example from the earlier category that kind of illustrates the point I was going to make? I can conceive of a 12-year-old or early adolescent who is dependent on their parents for their actual lodgings and food, etc.
Right.
They are independent intellectually and illustrative of that. The reason why they could be and yet still not be actually earning a living at that point is that what differentiates them from someone who is in the same position and who is not independent is that they are looking out what makes them their mind independent is that they are focusing on reality firsthand. They're acting blindly. And they're not just analyzing what somebody's saying, they're not looking at the action themselves and thinking about it.
Well, if I wanted to, I could say you've given an answer that's on the right track. But rather than do that, I want to focus on a different aspect. You're talking about a 12-year-old who is intellectually independent but is still dependent on his parents for financial support. And you're saying the essence of his independence is he still exercises his own mind firsthandedly, his own judgment. But then I would come back to you from the point of view of my dilemma and say, okay, That's not a moral sin against him, but he still isn't existentially independent. He's still, by your definition of the setup, even though his mind is fine, dependent in fact upon his parents. So that can't be the solution. That simply shows another form that I'm wrong to make that much of a fuss about earning a living, but still in some way, doing something in the material world in the form of self-sustenance is essential. So we can't go to the other direction of saying, well, it doesn't make any difference what you do in the world. As long as you think independently, you can lie in a bathtub and let people bring you the food. So we have to include some form of action. Now, I want to go back to not, I'm trying to isolate a methodological point here. Don't give me the answer to the problem, but tell me what I'm missing. And to highlight that for you, let me tell you what my first version was from a specific angle and see if you can see. Because it suddenly occurred to me that there was a grave deficiency in the entire discussion, much beyond anything I've named so far. And that is, I gave a definition, then I had part one and part two. Part one was independence in thought. Part two was independence in action. And what was my connection between those? I started with the definition, and the definition itself had two parts. One's acceptance of the responsibility of forming one's own judgments and of living by the work of one's own mind. So I just stuck down a definition that had two parts and then said, now let's discuss part one and then discuss part two. Now looking at it from that point of view, what is obviously missing? I heard it from somebody over here.
Integration.
I have two concretes in this section. Intellectual independence and existential independence with no abstraction uniting them. In other words, I have two species of independence, but I don't yet know what independence is. I have nothing integrating or connecting the elements. I have, to put it another way, two aspects of a virtue, but I don't know how to unite these forms. And putting it, using the word that starts with a P, what am I missing? PR. What is the principle of independence? The principle that subsumes all of its variants, I'm not asking that, I'm just elaborating on this question, that interconnects all of them, and in relation to which all of them, including intellectual and existential, are just examples. Now here I found myself in this position. I have lectured for years on the crucial role of thinking in principle. I have been writing and thinking for weeks on this particular sequence without knowing the principle and without even knowing that that's what I didn't have. Now that to me was a true revelation, because I would not have thought, given the degree of knowledge that I have on the subject of the urgency of principle, that I could go that long and work that hard in a completely unprincipled fashion. Now, I don't mean unprincipled in the sense that I would rob a bank, but unprincipled in the sense that at that moment I didn't know the principle as to why you shouldn't rob a bank, because that comes under existential independence. You see, there is a big difference between a principle and a definition. That's one of the things that threw me off. A definition, now I'm not stating this as an unrestricted law of thought, because I'd have to think through a great deal more, and this is the subject of the book after the one I'm doing, which is scheduled to be published in the 21st century. But a definition is out to distinguish, to separate a certain phenomenon from everything else. So its main cognitive role is differentiation, at least from the aspect we're here talking about. But a principle is the other side of cognition. It is integration. It's what connects a vast diversity. And on some of the other virtues, I got it right. And what I found, and the ones where I got it right, is that the subheading stated the principle, and then the definition elaborated it. For instance, take justice. The subheading was the principle. Rationality in the evaluation of men. Now that left wide open. What does rationality in the evaluation of men consist of? And then we have time now for a definition. And the definition says, well, you have to judge them morally, you have to judge their character and conduct morally, and then part of the process of being rational and evaluating them is giving them what they deserve, acting according, you know, to your evaluation. So the definition by itself was already mired us in specifics. Evaluate a man's character objectively and then grant him what he deserves. But the reason you could chew each of those points and keep it all together is because under your mind, you know, it's rationality in the evaluation of men. So it's everything you know about man, reason and rationality, and about evaluation, and that applied to man. And that is the compass that keeps every aspect of the discussion unified. Now I thought to myself, I have to do exactly that with independence. And I have to find a principle which is wide enough to integrate all of the subdivisions, including intellectual and existential independence, but not so wide that it becomes rationality. It has to be a subdivision of rationality. Now you see here the terrible inadequacy of my original subhead, which is why Ayn Rand, from reading the subhead, would have said, it's not worth reading the sequence, throw it out and start over again. The original subheading was self-reliance in thought and action. Now, first of all, if you analyze that, to put in thought and action in the heading is already a confession of bankruptcy, because it's a principle that every virtue has an application in thought and action. So if you suddenly import that into your subhead, it means you've got nothing to say in your principle. And you feel that it's not enough to say independence is self-reliance, so you throw that in, deluding yourself into the idea, well, this is now, you know, I'm saying something. But once you strip that away, it comes down to independence is self-reliance. Well, what's the difference? That's not an analysis, that's not a principle, that's a synonym. Independence is the negative word. IN is a negative prefix, it means not relying on others. So instead, rely on yourself. So it ended up that this alleged principle that's supposed to be stating the integrating essence was contentless. Only, of course, it escaped me completely. What I need now is a real subhead, and I'm not speaking now not just literarily, but now back to in terms of thinking. I need to know the principle of independence. Now, what is it? It has to be broader than thinking independently, and it has to be broader than supporting yourself independently. If you say acceptance of reality, if that's all you say, I say, well, I can't distinguish it from rationality. Rationality is the acceptance of reality. And in another way, I could say honesty is the acceptance of reality. So that's too broad. Now, if you think this is easy, it's at the same time impossible and self-evident. All right, now I'm sure one of you will get it right off the bat. I didn't get it at this stage. I was completely baffled. I thought to myself, here I am, after 40 years, and I can't state what independence is. And I'm writing a book on Ayn Rand's philosophy. This is a catastrophe. So you can just imagine what I went through. Now I'm sure that four people here will tell me right off the bat and make me feel even worse. Yes.
Guiding your action by the use of your own mind.
No, that is just rationality. The commitment to guiding your action by the use of your own mind, as formulated, is just rationality. Rationality says two things. Think and act according. Now, of course, if you make a big fuss over the word your own mind, and you explain that, you would be in a certain direction. But if you put too much emphasis on the other parts of the sentence, well, you know, in writing and thinking, you have to state it in such a way that it doesn't take a Jesuitical scholar 14 years to figure out what you might have intended. You have to hit them over the head with it. Now, we're running out of time here. I'm going to give one more person a chance. All right, the very back. Yeah.
Acceptance of the fact that values must be earned by you.
No, that, you say, acceptance that values must be earned by you. By the very fact of stressing earned, you're already confusing us with justice. And you're giving us much too concrete a specification, because obviously it has to apply to cognition and not just objects that we go out to get. All right, now before you give me 12 others, let me pick up again, because I don't want to run out altogether of time here. I'll give you a little clue. I'll tell you what I did. I began to wonder, where will I find even a lead to this? And then, of course, the next logical question that occurred to me is, well, I wonder where Ayn Rand discusses this question. And then it came to me like a revelation. That is what The Fountainhead is about. That is the theme of The Fountainhead. Now that really, it was like a thunderbolt from heaven. Because I thought to myself, here, I know The Fountainhead virtually by heart. I mean, I know it much better than Atlas Shrugged, because I read it, and then as soon as I got to the end, I read it as a teenager when I was living alone in Canada. And I just got to the end and started again at the beginning, round and round. I must have read it, oh, 4 or 5 dozen times anyway. And I was able, in spite of that fact, to omit its essence in presenting the virtue of independence. Because the whole intellectual purport of The Fountainhead is how you distinguish the independent man from the dependent man. Now that I've given you that much, what is the essential distinction in the broadest principled terms, nakedly stated over and over in The Fountainhead, which is not rationality?
First-handedness
versus the second-hand. Now just put that in somewhat different terms. In terms of what is their primary object of focus, there's two alternatives. One type's primary object of focus is reality, and the other type's is people. Now that is already narrower than rationality, which just says think and act accordingly. It doesn't tell you where you can go off the ropes. This is much more specific. It tells you a particular way to go off the ropes, and that is to put people above reality. And conversely, therefore, it implies that if you want to follow rationality, one crucial thing is in every issue, you got to distinguish what is the role of people and what is reality. Say it, go by reality rather than by people. Now, I started, once this occurred to me, to skim the relevant passages in The Fountainhead with a new eye. Of course, I didn't even get this far, actually. I just got the first-hander versus the second-hander, and I realized I hadn't really made much use of that except come to conclusions independently. But that was a much broader concept, first-handedness. So I thought, I'll just read through, you know, some of the key speeches from that point of view, and I was thunderstruck by what I found. Now, I'm just going to read you three, and what I did. Every time I found a passage that seemed vaguely relevant, I just typed it out. And pretty soon I had page after page, and the recurring theme was unavoidable. I'll read you three quotes. Now, you must have memorized these, because they're obvious from Rourke's speech or from Rourke and Winans's discussion. Quote, "They have no concern for facts," as they being second-handers, "have no concern for facts, ideas, work. They're concerned only with people. They don't ask, is this true? They ask, is this what others think is true? Not to judge, but to repeat. not to do but to give the impression of doing, not creation but show, not ability but friendship, not merit but pull. What would happen to the world without those who do, think, work, produce? Those are the egoists. That's one quote. Now right there you see is already 100 times superior to my entire sequence. Now here's another one from the Fountainhead. The independent man, quote, is the man who stands above the need of using others in any manner. He does not function through them. He is not concerned with them in any primary matter, not in his aim, not in his motive, not in his thinking, not in his desires, not in the source of his energy. You see the freedom there with which you can't say, is she talking about intellectual? Is she talking about existential? She's talking about independence. And it subsumes everything. I'll give you one more. The moral law, quote, this is straight out of the Fountainhead, I assume you know, is never to place one's prime goal within the persons of others. A man's moral obligation is to do what he wishes, provided his wish does not depend primarily upon other men. This includes the whole sphere of his creative faculty, his thinking, his work. But it does not include the sphere of the gangster, the altruist, and the dictator. A man thinks and works alone. A man cannot rob, exploit, or rule alone. Robbery, exploitation, or ruling presuppose victims. They imply dependence. They are the province of the second-hander. Well, you know, by this point, it was like it's now become self-evident. And I realize what I have to do. I have to, as with all the other virtues, start with the definition. But then, before I start discussing what is intellectual aspect of it, or what is the existential aspect of it, I have to explain the essence of the principle of independence. Before I descend to any concretes, I have to state the principle, explain it, validate it, and tie it in the form of a principle back to its basic philosophic roots in metaphysics and epistemology, which of course now is cut and dried, and if you don't see it, you will in a minute. And then, given that context, treat the intellectual and the existential aspects as just chewing of what I've already discussed in principle. And that gave me the pie theory, P-I-E. Having discovered this, I can walk, right? I had written, remember the entire, can you still hear me? I had written the entire chapter already, and I had made this mistake on every virtue, but some, by luck, I had lucked out and got the principle in the subhead. But even so, I had given the definition and then went straight to intellectual and existential. So I devised this system, P-I-E. I went through, this is over 100 pages, every sentence, and I had to ask myself, does this sentence belong under the principle of this virtue? That's P. Under the intellectual chewing of what it means intellectually, or under the E, under the existential side of it? And I had to take each sentence and sometimes phrase, and put a P, an I, or an E under it, and then take scissors and cut it up into just, you know, three piles for each virtue of little fragments and scraps, and then paste them on sheets of paper and try to figure out a logical order within each, and then redo the entire chapter so that every virtue is now the principle, which is the deepest statement, integrating all of it and tied back to the basic philosophic roots, and then the intellectual and the existential as two chewing of it. And it made a tremendous difference. It made even virtues that were really clear, really clear, because now I could see what the hell I was talking about, whereas I had things all mixed up. I had the principle as part of the intellectual. I would have part of the principle under the intellectual and the other part under the existential, so usually it was all there, but it just wasn't. It was unprincipled. Now, let me read you my the final treatment of independence with some interpolated commentary as we go, so you can see the differences that were made, even down to the finest points, by the fact of approaching it in a principled rather than an unprincipled way. Now, of course, the whole thing is in the subhead. Self-reliance in thought and action is gone. And now it reads, independence as the primary orientation to reality, comma, not to other men. Independence as the primary orientation to reality, not to other men. Now, what kills me is all the objectivists are going to read that and think it's self-evident. You know, as if, well, what the hell? And after the time it took me to reach that. Now, I trust you understand the reason for the word primary. It's explained later in the discussion. But if you left out the word primary, what would it imply? It implied that you're blind to other men. You just don't, you aren't cognizant of the fact that they exist. So this is an issue of what comes first. It's not an issue of whether you acknowledge other men. And now here is the final presentation. I start with the same definition. The virtue of independence, in Ayn Rand's definition, is, quote, one's acceptance of the responsibility of forming one's own judgments and of living by the work of one's own mind, unquote. Now that's already clearer, even in the light of the subheading, than before, but of course that's just the beginning. Now, I go into this, and you'll forgive me for the fact that I start right off with a long quotation from Rourke's speech, which I justified on the grounds that if I needed it, having written it, read that book 40-odd times, nobody can complain if I quote from it. So I go right into the classic objectivist statement of this virtue appears in The Fountainhead, when Rourke contrasts the creator with the second-hander. Quote, nothing is given to man on earth. Everything he needs has to be produced. And here man faces his basic alternative. He can survive in only one of two ways, by the independent work of his own mind or as a parasite fed by the minds of others. The creator originates, the parasite borrows. The creator faces nature alone, the parasite faces nature through an intermediary. The creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of men. The creator lives for his work. He needs no other men. His primary goal is within himself. The parasite lives secondhand. He needs others. Others become his prime motive. The basic need of the creator is independence. The reasoning mind demands total independence in function and in motive. To a creator, all relations with men are secondary. The basic need of the second-hander is to secure his ties with men in order to be fed. He places relations first, unquote. Now, I put it to you that there is no validation of independence beyond that. That is the whole thing, and the rest is just elaborating and chewing and clarifying what might be confusing to people. You cannot beat that. There is no other case for independence as a matter of principle than that excerpt from Rourke's speech. Now, here's my elaboration, still within the limit of the discussion of P, the principle. If a man lived on a desert island, a policy of dependence would be impossible to him. He would have to think, act, produce on his own, or suffer the consequences. He would have to focus on reality or perish. The same principle holds true when one lives in society. The presence of other men does not change the nature of man or the requirements of his life. Others can properly offer one many kinds of values. They cannot, however, become one's means of survival or basic frame of reference. They cannot be treated as a substitute for reason or reality. Not with impunity. Now you see right away the terms, by the fact of casting it on the breadth of a principle, I'm talking about reason and reality and the person who faces reality versus the people who let other people become the equivalent of reason and reality, so that I am now in the midst of the deepest issues of philosophy, of metaphysics and epistemology, by the very nature of a principle. I have not only integrated in the various concretes of independence, I've integrated the virtue into the whole foundations. This is just the first sign of that. But the writing is thrown, the thinking is thrown into the integrating mode, so that instead of self-support, you know, which just takes you nowhere, it's reality as your frame of reference, and reason your means of survival versus other people. And that takes your reason, reality, and right back to the foundations. And that's why it takes the genius to define independence and validate it, and not just the Protestant ethic. You get the difference? So a principle, and the definition didn't do this, but the principle did. So there is really instructive. Let me go on. The independent man, in Ayn Rand's words, I quoted from her liberally here because I figured you can't overdo quoting on this virtue, obviously. The independent man, in Ayn Rand's words, quote, does not function through others. He is not concerned with them in any primary matter, not in his aim, not in his motive, not in his thinking, not in his desires, not in the source of his energy, unquote. Now, of course, I realize clarifications are going to be necessary. Because 100 people are going to say, oh, but how can you live? You need all these things from other people and so on. So I add the following. In a social context, the independent man learns from others and may choose to work with them on a joint endeavor. But the essence of his learning and of his work is the process of thought which he has to perform alone. He needs others with whom to trade, but the trade is merely an exchange of creations. And his primary concern is the act of creating, i.e. his own work. He may love another person and even decide that he does not care to live without that person. But he chooses his love as a complement to his work, and he chooses by his own rational standards for the sake of his own happiness. He may enjoy receiving approval from others, but others are not the source of his self-esteem. He esteems himself, then enjoys any approval he receives only if he independently approves of the approvers. This kind of man gains many values from mankind and offers many values in exchange, but mankind is not his motor, his sustainer, or his purpose. Ayn Rand describes such an individual as the man of, quote, self-sufficient ego, unquote. And now here's my elaboration of the subhead, which is now prepared. The primary in his consciousness, that which comes first in any issue, is not other men, but reality as perceived by his mind. In fundamental terms, such a man does not need others. In principle, he acts among men just as he would without them. He is as alone in society as on a desert island. And that is my own statement. I think that is a clear way of capturing the essence of the issue. He is as alone in society as on a desert island. The opposite policy consists, you have to state an opposite to make the contrast clear, consists in dropping one's mind as one's guide and accepting in its stead a different kind of primary, people. This type of person is not moved by a grasp of logic or truth. He is oriented basically not to reality, but to other men, to what they believe, what they feel, what he can wheedle out of or pump into them, what he can do to, with, or for them. Now, of course, once we're thinking on this broad level of principle, we're not restricted to intellectual, existential, or Martian. A flood of examples of all kinds pour into the mind. And I offer some here just to concretize. And deliberately throw in every possible variety, including the kitchen sink, to give people the idea of the breadth and the scope of what we're talking about. The man who acquires his ideas by conforming unthinkingly to the consensus of his significant others. The man who gains his sense of self-worth from prestige or love. In other words, from acceptance in the eyes of others, regardless of their standards of judgment. The man who gets ahead not through work, but through pull. The social worker whose function is not to create, but to redistribute the wealth created by others. The criminal or dictator who lives by initiating force against the mind of others. These are some of the second-handers described in The Fountainhead. They are men who live through or within others, men to whom solitude in principle means death. And that is the essence of dependence. A parasite, biologically, is a creature that lives on or in an organism of another species. The second-hander, however, is unique. He has no counterpart in the world of biology. He is a parasite on his own species. All right, now I've made the principle clear, and I'm prepared to go into its deepest metaphysical, epistemological, and ethical roots, that is, the integration back to the foundation. Now I had the effrontery to make the following transition sentence. The relationship between the virtue of independence and the fundamentals of metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics is readily apparent. Now, that's a lie if ever I heard one. Except at this point, it was true, because now I saw it. So first we're going to do metaphysics. Now you have to remember that I've already had hundreds of pages laying down all this groundwork, so I'm just cashing in on it. So the first point I make is, whether explicitly or otherwise, the independent man grasps the distinction between the metaphysical and the man-made. Now, you recall that distinction from Ayn Rand's Metaphysics. Those facts which are inherent in reality as such, and those facts which are a product of human choice, and which could be otherwise. The metaphysical is the given which you must accept and adjust to, and can't evaluate. The man-made is a product of choice and must be evaluated as good or not. Now, cashing in on that distinction, which is the essence of her view in metaphysics, there is a reality independent of us and has certain facts whether we like it or not. Conformity to the metaphysically given, the independent man understands, is essential to successful action. The man-made may be accepted only if and when it achieves such conformity. This kind of individual, as the independent one, fulfills the basic requirement of human survival. He knows how, by reference to what absolute, to form his evaluations and choose his actions. To the second-hander, by contrast, the man-made, whether rational or irrational, good or evil, true or false, becomes the equivalent of reality. This kind of person, having detached himself from actual reality, has no standard by which to judge others. He has no way to know whose ideas to follow, whose behavior to copy, whose favor to curry. Such an individual reduces himself to helplessness, the fundamental helplessness of having left his life to the mercy of blind chance. The result is most people's desperate need for an authority, religious or secular, who will take over their lives, make their value judgments, and tell them what to do. The independent man will refuse any such role, but the most destructive second-hander of all, the power luster, is eager to accept it, and in the process to destroy everyone, himself included. Now, just in case anybody didn't get this metaphysical point, I'm going to reformulate it, the same point, from another aspect, using the concept of the primacy of existence, which has also been established in detail. The primacy of existence, of course, being the idea that existence comes first, consciousness is the faculty of grasping it, as against the idea that consciousness comes first and existence must adapt. The independent man accepts and lives by the primacy of existence. In some terms, he understands that A is A, no matter what men's desires or illusions to the contrary. The dependent switches to the primacy of consciousness. He devotes himself not to the identification of that which is, but to imitating, appeasing, serving, or forcing the consciousnesses on whom he depends. Now, it's interesting here, although we don't have the time, it's not worth doing it. If you remember the passage I read you on Stadler, where I was trying to say why he would end up with a corrupted psychology, I was groping in this direction, but I could never formulate it because I was keyed into this validation of why you shouldn't be a beggar, and so all my formulations are much too narrow and restricted. But this was the idea that, of which the Stadler example, that's why I had the veneer of plausibility to me, but the real point was that it's infinitely broader than pertaining to a beggar. It pertains to the basic relation of consciousness to existence, the primacy of existence versus primacy of consciousness. And I couldn't see through to that connection before I could see to the principle underneath the intellectual and the existential sides. As to reality, the second-hander or the dependent man believes, insofar as he considers the issue at all, that he can safely leave that realm to others to deal with. Nothing he feels is more powerful than my neighbors, my tribe, my colleagues, my armies, or my leader. Now, that is an Ayn Rand, if I say so myself, type sentence. But I'm not saying it as a boast. I'm trying to say the kind of integration, you see, where in one sentence you're showing the same attitude in the guy on the street looks to his neighbors, the primitive man looks to his tribe, the professor in the economics department looks to his colleagues, Attila or Hitler looks to his armies, you know, the abject subject of a dictatorship looks to his leader. And the point is, this is where you need a philosopher. It's not just the beggar with the tin cup looking for someone. Anybody knows that concrete. Where Ayn Rand's genius comes in is to be able to tie across the centuries and across space and time and all of its forms the same error over and over and see that it's the same error, you see. And that therefore, when you get to talk about the beggar, it isn't even worth talking about. It's just too obvious because once, in her mind, once she said existence exists, that takes care of the beggar. And that's why she had this continuous bafflement with people where they would say, what about so-and-so? And she said, but I already said ASA. You know? And that just across a gulf like that because she really had it integrated on that level. And it, if you can do it, it's fabulous. All right, that's metaphysics. Now, the independent man understands in some terms that reason is man's means of knowledge. So we're coming to epistemology now. And thus accepts the responsibility of practicing the virtue of rationality. The parasite cannot justify his own default, but he does not want to do the necessary work. In other words, to exert the effort which an independent, creative existence would require. He wants the so-called freedom, when he feels like it, to coast mentally or evade. So I've tied this now, you know, the essence of evil. Now listen to this. Such a person is not always a passive type. See, now that I've got the principle, I have the answer to the innovative bank robber, so I'm throwing that in for the same price. Such a person is not always a passive type. He may struggle, act, even make long-range plans and figure out in detail the means of implementing them. For example, he may spend years planning how to rob a bank or enslave a nation. But none of this qualifies as effort in the moral sense or as rationality. Within the framework of the parasite's life, struggle does not represent a commitment to focusing on reality or to exercising his conceptual faculty. On the contrary, it is an attempt to escape from reality and from the need to conceptualize. There is no such thing as a fact-based or principled parasitism. There is only a brazen double standard. He will work and I will get away with my desire to cash in on the results. And now I generalized to make entirely clear why you can't say the innovative bank robber or the hard-working dictator is an exponent of reason. Mental activity motivated by whim and streaked with evasion is not a form or expression of reason, but of its opposite. Just as inferences drawn from arbitrary premises and riddled with contradictions are the opposite of logic. Now, you would have to have read my section on logic, but that's covered. That objectivism does not regard logic as being start with any two arbitrary propositions and derive a conclusion from them. And the broader issue, as I explained earlier in the book, is holding the context. So I say neither reason nor logic can be defined in terms of context dropping. So here now I have an integration back to the essence of epistemology. And now I have to integrate the principle of independence to the foundations of ethics. And that'll give me all of the integration, the key elements in metaphysics, epistemology, and now ethics. The ego or self, Ayn Rand holds, is the mind. The independent man, therefore, is the only real egoist. The second-hander, whether he seeks to exploit others or to serve them, is an opposite breed. In placing people above reality, he renounces his ego. Whatever his goal or intended beneficiary, such a man, quote, places others above self, quote, in the deepest sense, and pays the price. The price lies in the fact that the selfless is the mindless. Now you see now, from that very subhead now, the definition, the formal definition of altruism is placing others above self, is in principle an exhortation to dependence in the utter, immoral, corrupt sense. The very formulation, place others above self, becomes a statement of corruption. If you see now what independence is and how it ties into the foundations. So there's no wonder that Ayn Rand was so militantly anti-altruist. And again, she would say, because existence exists. If man's survival depends on the proper functioning of his consciousness, then Ayn Rand's ethics is not arbitrary. Her theory of egoism as independence defines the one mode of human life in which, as a matter of principle, man is able to be conscious. Now that concludes the principle, its validation, and its integration. And now comes the chewing, which becomes now just a breeze. It writes itself. It's still necessary because so far we're on still a pretty broad level, although I've given examples. I don't want to take the chance of it being a floating abstraction, and after all, ethics is a guide to human life. So you want to lay down some pretty specific guidelines. But these guidelines are fine as concrete guidelines so long as it's within the framework of a principle. But if it's only independent means, think for yourself and then support yourself, you're lost completely, you see. So it's, the whole thing is in, do you provide the context or not? So now we go to the division. Intellectually, independence is reliance on one's own judgment in coming to conclusions. It is one's recognition of the fact that the mind is an attribute of the individual and that no person can think for another. You see, we're narrowing down now to cognition, which is what intellectual independence pertains to. An independent thinker is one who processes perceptual material by the use of his own rational faculty. In dealing with any question, whether a fact or value, end or means, philosophy or science, he follows the method of what? Objectivity. Now that just wrote itself. You see, once I had the principle, all my old formulations in lectures were he uses his own judgment. And then you always had to explain, of course he has to be objective, he can't just, not just because he feels like it. But now I realize since the essence of independence is the focus on reality, the way to define intellectual independence is, in every question the man follows the method of objectivity, which is the focus on reality, you see. A second-hander, by contrast, is a parasite of cognition who accepts the ideas of others on faith. He is the man who says, I don't care whether others have reasons for their conclusions or not. If an idea is good enough for my neighbors or my grandfather or my subjects or the Pope or the President, it's good enough for me. Unquote. Now, the next paragraph is intact virtually from my first version. The term independent thought is a redundancy. Either a man is struggling to identify facts, to integrate, to understand, this is at once a state of thought and of intellectual independence, or he accepts the mental contents of other men without regard to facts, logic, understanding. This is a state of dependence and of non-thought. Even if the ideas that he accepts in this fashion happen to be true, they are of no cognitive value to the parasite. In his consciousness, those ideas are not truth, but they are arbitrary. And that ties back to the earlier discussion in the Book of Truth. They are dogma without connection to knowledge or to reality. Now, I have a paragraph here that I don't think is necessary for this audience about independence doesn't mean turning your back on the accumulated knowledge of the past. I think that's too elementary for you. I'll just read the summation of that. Virtue does not require that one's mental contents be his own original discovery. What it requires is a certain method of dealing with one's mental contents, whoever initially conceived them. The moral issue is not who was first, but is one a man of reason or of faith? Now here's an important clarification, because objectivism is constantly haunted by subjectivists who like the word individualism and equate it with a whim worship, and their idea of being an individualist is, I believe it, therefore it's true. That's the way I feel. So, you know, you have to fight those people off all the time. So I put this one in. A rational man does not treat independence as the validation of an idea. He does not say, as certain subjectivists do, I accept this idea, therefore it must be true. On the contrary, he is independent precisely in order to be objective. So I've not only dissociated subjectivists, I've said you're the opposite of independence. The independent man says this idea is true in reason, therefore I accept it. Similarly, independence is not the assertion of one's own feelings, regardless of the reasons behind them. This widespread viewpoint, which would turn independence into the vice of whim worship, evades the fact that independence is a trait applicable only to the function of the mind. If a person accepts certain ideas because he has looked at reality firsthand, then he is an independent man regardless of his feelings, no matter how similar they are to those of other men. Conversely, if he has turned his soul over to society, to program, then he is a dependent, no matter how unique any of his feelings happen to be. The man who takes pride in the independence, in quotes, of his feelings is usually dominated by one feeling in particular, hostility towards other men. Typically, his notion of being independent in the realm of ideas is to affront others by rejecting whatever they believe simply because they believe it. By definition, such a person is unconcerned with logic or reality. His mental contents are shaped entirely by other men in reverse. This kind of mentality, which poses as being courageous and self-assertive, represents an especially ugly form of dependence. I just permitted myself one adjective there because I hate that type. I try to keep out words like ugly, depraved, vicious, brazen, and so on. But every once in a while, you know, there's a lot of them in the first draft, and I edit them out. Now, of course, someone is going to be there from the liberal side saying, well, what if you had a poor upbringing? We've already covered free will, but I just have to once more. Since intellectual independence is a product of the choice to think, it is a volitional attainment open to everyone. A man can be cognitively helped or hampered by his environment, but he cannot be turned into a thinker or a zombie without his own consent, leaving aside cases such as the infliction of physical torture or damage. A thinker, therefore, always deserves moral credit for being such, regardless of his parents, his teachers, his society, and a zombie, moral blame. And now, finally, we get to the existential side of the virtue of independence. Now, the first sentence, I want you to hear the difference here. The first sentence is the straight same as the first sentence I gave you last time from the other draft. Thought is not an end in itself, but a means to action in reality. But now, if you remember, I went on the other time saying, since we've already established rationality or intellectual independence, I'll now show you. I said, in effect, if intellectual independence is the standard, then etc. Now listen to where I go. Thought is not an end in itself, but a means to action in reality. If life is the standard, a man must think in order to gain knowledge, then use his knowledge to guide him in creating the material values his life requires. This means he must be a self-supporting entity. He must finance his activities by his own productive effort. He must work for a living. In other words, the reason that the validation was so elusive is that there is no special validation of existential independence. There's the principle, two ways of looking at reality, looking at it or not looking at it, but instead looking at people. And then, of course, that has its manifestation in thought and its manifestation in action. But if you try to separate them and give a separate validation of each, then by the fact of that assignment, you've lost the principle, and then all you can do is be rationalistic. And I decided I want to throw in here a reminder, because you write a book primarily for yourself, to anybody who might be tempted, you know, to look for some special thing here. The whole thing is this: a book has to be full of clues without telling the reader. Now I'm putting this in because you might make the mistake I did. It just has to flow. But the fact is, I'm trying to tell people, do not try in distinguishing the intellectual from the existential to dichotomize them or separate them too far. So I wrote it instead this way. Since man is an integration of two attributes, mind and body, every virtue reflects this integration. None can be practiced spiritually but not materially, or vice versa. The dependent in spiritual issues does not think, and so creates no wealth. He becomes thereby a dependent in matter. The dependent in material issues makes the actions of others his means of survival. He becomes thereby a dependent in spirit. So instead, I turn my problem into a virtue. Instead of being able to separate them, I'm proud now that they're all interconnected. If a man is to be first-handed, he must begin by reaching independent conclusions. Then he must accept the responsibility of acquiring on his own the means necessary to implement his conclusions in practice. He must be self-reliant in the mental and in the physical world. Here's the one and only time I let myself get away with the word self-reliant, because I'm just tired of using independence. Now I have a clarification that I don't think you need about why you don't have to live on a desert island to be independent, as long as you produce the value equivalent in trade with others. I don't think you need that. I'll pick up here. It is often said that no one is independent because we all rely on others. For example, on the grocer who supplies us with bread. This claim evades an obvious question. Do you pay your grocer? Or do you offer him only a sob story or a stick-up? The term dependence in its pejorative sense cannot be stretched to subsume both these policies. Those who find this distinction difficult to grasp and who prattle about the, quote, interdependence of our, quote, complex society may seek further clarification from any grocer. See, by this stage of the game, if the person has grasped the principle, they will just laugh at this objection, and if they haven't, there's no use discussing it, because that means they're impervious to the point or to thought. Individuals who trade their own creations are not parasites. It is their antipodes, the non-creators, who are the dependents among men. And now I proceed to give a list of existential dependents, all covered by the same one principle. And it's precisely the fact that all of them flow, obviously, at this point, that reflects that you're dealing with a philosophy here and not, quote, common sense. And this is why only a genius like Ayn Rand could create a validation for independence. And now you'll see how one short sentence at a time, I take all my other problems and just tick them off. Now, the sentence again, introducing it was, it is their antipodes, the non-creators, who are the dependents among men. Some of them do not care to perform any kind of work, but plead for unearned support from others. In the terminology of Atlas Shrugged, these are the moochers. Others turn criminal and seize the unearned. These are the looters. Others peddle various forms of mysticism, for example, astrology, which, though non-criminal, contribute nothing to the maintenance of human life or actively undermine it. Others, by far the largest subcategory, are the Peter Keatings, who hold a legitimate job but drift through it out of focus, exercising no judgment, reaching no conclusions, merely imitating by rote the motions of those around them. All of these types are, quote, fed by the minds of others, that's Rourke's phrase, in the literal sense of fed. All want the effects of reason without the need of exercising the faculty. All seek not to practice virtue or to abolish it, but in Ayn Rand's eloquent phrase, to be hitchhikers of virtue. None has any answer to the question, by what right do you seek it, that is, to become such a hitchhiker. And now I give you a formal definition. My old definition of existential independence was working for a living, in effect. Existential independence, according to the objectivist ethics, means supporting oneself in a rational field of endeavor by using a first-handed approach. Now you see why all those elements are essential. A rational field, as against astrology, etc., and a first-handed approach, as against Peter Keating. And you see how both of those follow from the principle that it's the focus on reality rather than others. Now I elaborate. This means performing one's work with an active mind on the premise of understanding the job and finding ever better ways to do it, turning out standard values more efficiently, or discovering and offering superior products or services. Every job from ditch digging to philosophy begs for these kinds of innovation. What innovation requires, however, is a worker in full focus, ready to throw aside routine, question tradition, challenge the conventional bromides, and, if necessary, suffer opposition as a result, when the drones around him see that their lethargy is being disturbed. This type of worker on any scale of endeavor is the creator of wealth, through whose efforts all the non-creators live. He is the individual who fulfills Ayn Rand's definition of independence, one who, quote, lives by the work of his own mind, unquote. And now you see, by the time we get there, you see why she chose that word and that definition just as though it's self-evident. And now I wanted to conclude with a tribute to the Fountainhead, or a point from the Fountainhead. The role of independence in human life is writ large for all to see in the lives of the great creators. Not all independent men are great creators, but all great creators by definition have been independent men, at least to the extent of their creativity. These creators are the men who conceived or discovered on a grand scale what no one had conceived before them. They are the men whose achievements, from language, logic, and science to anesthesia, romantic symphonies, power looms, and spaceships, have lifted mankind out of the cave and into a human mode of existence. Whoever takes a great step forward leaves a chasm behind. In the best of societies, he has to wait patiently, alone, for other men to catch up. And most societies to date have been far from being the best. Hence the fate suffered so often through the ages by geniuses, inventors, and innovators. Not only hatred, ridicule, persecution, martyrdom, but the necessity to spend one's life and precious hours fighting against their root, against mental passivity, slothful ignorance, willful deafness, enshrined falsehood. And then I quote from Rourke, quote, but the men of unborrowed vision went ahead. They fought, they suffered, and they paid, but they won, unquote. No further argument for the virtue of independence should be necessary, not if man's life is the standard of value. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I left on an unhappy note last time, thinking what you would have to think of me if all you knew was the first version. But I feel better about it now. We do have I can go over a little, so we have time for questions, but I just want to make an epistemological observation concluding. And that is the real difficulty of philosophic thought. Because I had lectured on the issue of principle, I knew the fountainhead backwards, and yet I could flounder with an unprincipled presentation and not even know it. And this, to me, points to the existence of a whole field, which is going to be the subject of my next book, which is, at least one crucial aspect, is how to think in principle self-consciously, methodically in all its ramifications, how not to leave it to chance whether you're doing it or not, because obviously giving a definition, following logic, and so on, does not prevent these gross pitfalls. And I think I have a lot of clues and ideas and directions, but that, of course, belongs in a whole book just on epistemology. But you see, there's a whole field of thought here that is what is my real interest and is the last thing I want to do with my life once I finish the present book. Okay, now we're ready for questions. And I understand we can go till 10 after, is that right? So we have 15 minutes. You've actually had some questions, believe it or not, because I regard the earlier class comments as questions. But all right, we have questions on independence. Now one per person. Haven't you asked already? Well, I'll let somebody brand new first, and then... Yeah?
I have a question on the initiation of force.
Oh, you're back on course, okay. As long as it's not foreign policy or the philosophy of law.
You stated that force is not good in relation to the victim because you cannot sunder value from the value of the process of cognition. And then you said that since there are no conflicts among rational men, force is also not good for the initiate. And I didn't understand that because the idea of conflict among rational
men... No, I didn't say that. You're misquoting me. I said, or for anyone else. I was much broader than the initiator. I said force doesn't produce any value for the victim. And since there are no conflicts of interest among men, it couldn't produce value for any other person at the price of his suffering because there's no conflicts of interest among rational men. So I was speaking much more broadly than the aggressor.
But isn't that inverting the hierarchy? Doesn't the issue of conflict among rational men come later?
No, it comes earlier. The issue of conflict among men, as in my hierarchy, comes under egoism. It's intrinsic to grasping what is egoism. And egoism is foundational to an ethics. The foundations of an ethic lie in three questions. This is my statement in chapter 7, the chapter preceding this. What is the fundamental value? What is the fundamental virtue? And what is the fundamental beneficiary? What should you be after? By what means and for whom or what? And then, all those questions are logically interconnected. Any answer on one has ramifications for the other three. That forms the unit. That is the foundations of ethics. That's the chapter I call the good. And then you go into the various virtues. And the issue that there's no conflict of interest arises from specifying what is meant by egoism within the framework of rationality. See, egoism has to be covered after rationality, not before. There's a reason for everything. Yes. Now I'm trying to hold you to your honor, since I can't see that far, that you're not, we're giving everybody one chance. Yes.
Regarding the issue of independence versus dependence, one thing that comes to mind is you talk about the independent man being tied in directly with his perception of reality.
Yeah.
Number two is we talk about other consciousness, which would be, and it's inferred and it's talked about as other people's consciousness. But I'm wondering about whether it's not broader than that. In fact, maybe, like, for instance, you know people that have animals that more or less run their lives. They look at their dog and their dog says something. They say, well, he wants this, and they do that. It's a consciousness that you could also say, what about a Martian or another being from that would come in? You run into another consciousness. Would not you say that independent mind is exclusive of any other consciousness? That it is.
Only yes, I understand your point. Your point is, why say independence is the primary orientation to reality, not to other men, rather than not to other consciousnesses? That is contextual. I don't agree with your example of animals, because however slavish a man was on his pet, he simply couldn't follow it for guidance in his daily life. The pet, being on the perceptual level, would have no views on vast numbers of questions on which the man needed an answer. So the pet could not function as a surrogate minister or priest. Now, a Martian might, and as you said, and conceivably a Martian would be so different from us that you couldn't even call him a human being. In that context, this would obviously be dated. And it would have to, but then I wouldn't know how to substitute, because another consciousness would be too broad. I don't know whether the Martian would be a conceptual being or not. If it was conceptual, then that would be the common thing, and you could say independence is the primary orientation to reality, not to any conceptual consciousness. You wouldn't just say any consciousness, because it's too broad and it wouldn't be applicable. But I don't know, since I don't know the Martian, I don't know how to specify what, maybe it's a super species that's got a super form of consciousness. I can only write in a context. And I have to assume that I make the thing so clear that as and when adaptations are necessary, the next millennium will be able to make the necessary adaptations. By the same token, they may find something in economics that makes gold, you know, completely odious. Some form of, I'm sure this is heresy, George, you'll forgive me, but liquid little stuff or something that's very easy to transport and divide and carry around, etc. And they all switch over to being on that, the gold standard. That would not invalidate classical economics. So on that level, I want to stick with what is known, and all definitions and even all principles have to be formulated in that context. I don't want to be needlessly broad where there's no reason for it within what we now know. Yes?
I'm hoping you could clarify the integration of existential and intellectual independence, specifically the example of the 12-year-old who is dependent on his parents for support,
yeah.
Or a quadriplegic who...
Now, those two are not the same thing. A 12-year-old and a paralyzed individual are morally, remember, this is virtue, entirely different. A person who is crippled, let's take that first, and unable to support himself, obviously cannot have enjoined on him as a moral obligation that he support himself. Because support takes not only thought, but action. And if he's incapable of the action, you know, in today's world, he probably could support himself because he could have a laptop, computer, you know, and whichever. But I don't know, maybe he's a ballet dancer and his only skill is gone and, you know, he just can't dictate anything that'll bring him a living. A person like that depends on charity.
Yes.
Wait a minute. Virtues are all defined according to the requirements of a healthy being. Insofar as a man can live at all, he's got to follow them. insofar as he's impaired and can't, he has to depend on charity. Virtue, however, does not take into account. Virtue doesn't. The requirements of a crippled case. And in that sense, the ancient parallel is exactly correct between athletics or gymnastics and virtue. When they give rules for how to train a body, you know what they call gymnastics, you couldn't go up and say, well, these rules are obviously no good because I just had my appendix out and I couldn't, you know, I can't follow these rules. They would tell you, look, this is gymnastics. This is not medicine. That's what the ancients would say. And we say exactly the same thing with regard to virtue. If you're physically unable to practice it, you can't be a self-generated, self-sustaining human being. Then you're dependent on charity. So obviously you can't practice what you can't do. Now a 12-year-old is a different case. Every one of us at one point was 12-year-old. On every virtue, you have to go through a transition stage from the baby, which is the perceptual level of consciousness, who can't practice any of them, because they're all defined in terms of volition and the conceptual faculty, to the adult, which for the sake of argument we make 18. Now, you can expect of a 12-year-old that within his own framework, he is A, intellectually independent, but there you can't blame him if he isn't. In other words, if he's precocious and he has a good training, he can ask a certain number of whys. But at age of 12, beyond a certain point, he simply hasn't got it unless he's a super genius like Ayn Rand. And in which case then, if he simply accepts an idea because that's the way people around him think, you can't say, look at that rotten little kid. You know, at 18 you can start to say, you know, he's going to college. Well, that's a bad example. But if he's going to college, he loses the ability to think. But you can say, you know, he's grown up now. He should start to ask some questions. So your demand is exactly commensurate with his degree of development. Intellectually, and the same is true existentially. A 12-year-old should be acquiring some skills that will one day develop into a career. But that does not mean he's got to know what the field is. It doesn't mean, you know, he's got to take lessons in accounting on the side so he'll always have something to fall back on, you know, like mothers advise their daughters in case they don't get married. I'm not talking about that type of thing. But he's expanding his knowledge. He's learning about the world. He's got interests. He's developing, if he's a healthy child, in a direction which in 6, 8, 10 years will become a career. That's all that the virtue of existential independence demands of him at that stage. And every virtue has the corresponding gradual development and becomes applicable in full only to physically unimpaired healthy adults. That's what we're talking about. George, you want me to stop?
Take one more
question. On independence, please. Okay.
Well, my question isn't on independence, but can I ask you?
All right, well, be independent and ask it anyway. Go ahead. Yeah.
I'd like to know if you would consider having a special session to discuss questions on your article, Fact and Value, because many of us have been discussing it amongst each other. And we have a lot of questions regarding the article, such as...
Such as is not necessary. Let me repeat, because our time is up. What I consider having a special session answering questions of my article, Fact and Value? No. But I wouldn't because I don't regard that as requiring a special session. I didn't regard it as requiring an article, if you want my honest opinion. But nevertheless, there were some people confused about some issues, so I batted it out very rapidly, without the least difficulty. But okay, I did that much. What I will do is reiterate, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to do so, at the end what I said at the beginning. I will be here at 1 o'clock. There'll be 30 minutes. You can write out, if you do it briefly on separate sheets of paper, as many questions as you want about that article. And just throw them in the box, and in order to confuse me, mix them all up with other people's questions. And if they are typed and brief, and I regard them as being of general interest, I don't regard that as a subject outside of discussion. but it'll just have to take its, you know, claim along with all the other questions. And if there's enough on the same question over and over, if you get all your friends to write it, I'll finally have to do it out of sheer attrition. That's it. See you on Saturday.